Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sometimes it pays to try something different. Of course, it often pays even better when you just go back to the same old, same old. Forbes magazine has released its list of the highest paid musicians in the world, and the list is full of familiar names, the tried and true bands and artists, although there were a few surprises there too, as we'll hear in a little while. But like I was saying, it is occasionally worth it to try something new. I once went to a sumo wrestling tournament at Madison Square Garden. I knew nothing about sumo except that it meant big, beefy Japanese men wearing way too little clothing. But a friend bought the tickets just on a lark, and you know what? It was great. It was really fun, and to my surprise, I was glad to be at the Garden that night, because normally I would be at the Garden helping to put some of those artists onto Forbes' list of highest-paid musicians. So, try something new occasionally. Maybe you're not a fan of electronica. Maybe you think it all sounds the same. Well, try this. That's the electronic music producer Flying Lotus and the virtuoso bass player and singer Thundercat. They had an underground hit with this song called Mm-hmm a couple of years ago. Lots of people have covered it, and now Thundercat has released a new album, and he and his band will play live for us in the Soundcheck studio. That's coming up in just a bit.
And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
that was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Time for another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about songs that have unexpectedly made their way to the top of the charts. And joining me here in the studio is Mario Correa, from SiriusXM's Entertainment Weekly Live. Mario, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, nice to see you, John.
With a song that seems like it probably shouldn't have even made it onto the radio, let alone on the charts.
That's absolutely right. So it's the spring of 1985. We Are the World had just been the number one song in America, famine in Ethiopia, and all of a sudden, a white English guy rapping about chess becomes the number three song on the Hot 100.
It comes from a musical.
It does. It does. It comes from a concept album for a musical called Chess. But even before that, I should tell you about this guy, Murray Head, because it sort of leads into this whole musical idea. So Murray Head is an English actor at the time. He's on a lot of TV shows in England and some movies. And in about 71 or so, he's in Hair on the West End of London. And Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice spot him in Hair. They like what he does. They say, hey, we're doing this concept album for a musical called Jesus Christ Superstar. Will you sing the role of Judas Iscariot for us? Mm-hmm. So he does, and he ends up having a number 14 pop hit in the U.S. with Superstar. So all of a sudden, you know, he's sort of a little pop guy. And flash forward about 7 or 8 years later, and Tim Rice has an idea for a musical about the Cuban Missile Crisis. But Andrew Lloyd Webber is not biting. He's going to go and write Cats, which I guess in hindsight was not a bad idea. Yeah. So Tim Rice says, all right, I'm going to go find someone else to write this musical about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he hooks up with Benny Andersson and Bjorn Ulvaeus from ABBA.
From ABBA.
Exactly. So they get together and they morph this idea and turn it into a musical about Soviet and U.S. Cold War tensions through the prism of these chess championships.
I love this. So Cuban Missile Crisis turns into a chess game.
Exactly. Meanwhile, you think like that Android Webber probably had a good idea to like avoid this altogether and go sing about felines. Yeah, yeah.
So Murray Head in this production of chess, he's the guy.
He's the guy.
Magnus Carlsen, the slick 22-year-old Norwegian who just won the championship last week.
Exactly. And even before he gets on stage, though, they need to create this concept album for the musical to sell the musical, to bring investors on, to build a following so they can put this thing on stage. So Tim Rice says, hey, I know a guy. I'm going to call Murray Head, the guy who sang on our concept album for Superstar. So Murray Head comes in, sings, and this song called One Night in Bangkok was supposed to begin the second act of the musical. And the idea is that, exactly, he's this chess master, the American, and he is going to Bangkok in the original version of the musical because it's changed many times. Mm-hmm. It's a problem musical, John. But in the original version, he's supposed to be there to essentially sort of comment on this great chess match in Bangkok. And he's all about the chess and not about Bangkok. And so in the song, he's dissing Bangkok while talking about how chess is why he's there. I can feel an angel sliding up to me. One town's very like another when your head's down over your pieces, brother. It's a drag, it's a bore. It's really such a pity to be looking at the bar, not looking at the city. What do you mean? You've seen one crowded, polluted, thinking town. Once sweet summer set up, with the summer set on sweet. Get tired, you're talking to a tourist whose every move's among the purest. I get my kids above the waistline, sunshine. One night in Bangkok makes the heart man humble. Not much between despair and ecstasy. One night in Bangkok and the tough guys crumble. Can't be too careful with your company. I can feel the devil walking next to me. Well, there is a reason we call this segment That Was a Hit. It's hard not to laugh when you're listening to it. Although I do think it's such a catchy melody, you know?
Full disclosure, I owned this song. I went out and bought this record.
You and me both. You and me both. But you know what's so funny? It's like, it's such a strange topic for a pop hit. But when you listen to the song, you have no idea what it's about. So I remember being like a 15-year-old kid my sophomore year in high school, you know, dancing the song, singing to it, thinking it was just the greatest thing. But then if you like listen to the lyrics, then it's, okay, it is about chess. You know, when he's like, one town's very like another when your head's down
over your pieces,
brother. Yeah. And then it's interesting, it's actually this dialogue between him and the locals. The locals are saying, no, it's a drag, it's a bore to be looking, it's a pity to be looking at the board when you're not looking at the city. So like, they're like trying to like create like a tourist interest in Bangkok. So then it kind of
fits
into that.
Well, and a certain type of tourist.
Well, that's true.
In Bangkok. You know, and the line, you know, I get my kicks above the waistline, sunshine.
Exactly sort of, right. Exactly right.
So this is from the concept album / musical called Chess, and the song is One Night in Bangkok, written and recorded in 84, and it hits the charts in 85. Murray Head is credited. I mean, that's his voice doing the spoken part, but somebody else is singing
exactly.
The chorus.
Exactly. Anders Glenmark actually did the chorus, and he was a session singer, Swedish session singer, who'd worked with ABBA previously, and he'd been a backup singer on a number of singles for various of the ABBA members and for the band, and so they brought him in. And so we associate Murray Head with singing the chorus, but no, that's actually not him. It's Anders Glenmark, and in fact, his sister is on that too. And then you have the Ambrosia singers, who are choral ensemble from London, who sang, and the London Symphony Orchestra is doing the orchestration. So, I mean, it's everyone except basically a white guy named Murray Head who's sort of behind this thing. But
And again, to just make clear, the song was written by the two guys behind the band, ABBA from Sweden, and Tim Rice. From Evita and Jesus Christ Superstar,
exactly.
Et cetera, which is where he first met and where we first heard Murray Head. Now, you mentioned the orchestra. The radio version was not the full song.
That's right. So they released two versions to radio. And this is where you can tell now, in hindsight, the theatrical roots of the song. There's a fully 1 minute long musical introduction, which if you can picture yourself sitting in the theater, it's the beginning of Act Two of Chess. The lights go down, and like many musicals, you have, you know, the orchestra swelling, you hear the songs, and, you know, the tunes, and then someone comes out and sings. Well, that's exactly what happened in the original One Night in Bangkok. You've got a minute of instrumental, and then that white guy rapping comes in and starts rapping about Bangkok. But most radio stations played a truncated version just starting at Murray Head's rap. And I think we have both versions.
We can actually, yeah, listen to the orchestral opening of the original version of One Night in Bangkok. And that is where most radio stations actually began the song.
That's exactly right. And you know, it's funny, when it took off as a single, which it did quickly, it actually peaked in 12 weeks. So that was a fairly fast rise up the charts. Then radio started playing the full version, because once, you know, you were familiar with it, you were willing to sort of listen to the whole thing. And it's funny listening to it now. I mean, it's both well done in a way, hilariously kind of camp and sort of like what an English/Swedish group of folks think Asia sounds like.
Well, yes,
you know?
It's got that kind of, you know, postcard exoticism to
right.
it.
Right. And the video is
the
like
cheese
that.
Factor, very high. Here.
Well, do you remember the video, John? I'm not sure if you saw
I
it.
I do remember the video, which involved like life-size chess pieces.
Exactly right. So essentially, like, he walks into this like Bangkok bar, and he's dressed exactly like Tom Wolfe in like head to toe like white suit with these white and black patent leather shoes. And then he's like starts rapping at us, and meanwhile the folks who are supposed to be the Thais in this equation, who look basically like sort of random non-English people in England mm-hmm. who were brought into the video to look like Thais, are there sort of playing the Thai role. And then there's a big sort of white and black linoleum floor in the back, which is sort of the chessboard, and there's these white folks dancing in these very sort of stylized moves. And it is really, it's the kind of thing where no wonder that it's sort of picking up steam again. There's 13 million views on YouTube for that single, because hipsters now look at that thing and think, these people are crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Mario Correa from SiriusXM's Entertainment Weekly Live, and this edition of our regular series, That Was a Hit, looking at the song One Night in Bangkok from the musical Chess, and featuring the English actor and singer Murray Head. How big a hit are we talking about
here? Huge. So the song was number one in many countries. It was number three on the Billboard Hot 100. It was the number five dance hit. It even hit on the R&B charts here in the States. Internationally, it was number three in Canada. It was number two in France and Norway. It went to number one in Spain. I mean, it was a big international hit. In the UK, interestingly, it was a bit smaller of a hit, a number 12 hit over there. Mm. But so much so that it was actually covered a number of times. So that very same year, oddly, a Canadian singer-songwriter named Roby covered the hit and had a dance club hit with it. And then a couple years ago, a German band also covered it. So it's had some lasting power. And, you know, you could not turn on Q107 in Bethesda, Maryland, where I was, a 15-year-old, and not hear One Night in Bangkok. But what's interesting, too, is, like, it rose fairly quickly. So it took 12 weeks to peak, and it dropped in 8. So it was the kind of thing where, like, people were like, oh, this is really cool, it's really interesting. And, yeah, not so much.
So the song itself is kind of like, you know, it ramps up with that orchestral thing, and then suddenly you're into the dance thing.
Right.
And then at the end, you have an equally abrupt drop-off at the end of the song, sort of betraying its roots as part of a musical.
That's exactly right, you know, because when I was listening to it now, I was thinking, well, how could I not have known right away that it was from a musical? Because, you know, most songs on the radio fade out, and which is both, you know, the musician's choice, but also helpful for folks playing the songs on the radio who can then talk over that fade out, introduce the next song, all the rest of it. Well, One Night in Bangkok just clips and just ends on one beat, and that's it, like sayonara, or otherwise on PC, vaguely Asian thing to say, not Thai. And so listening, you're like, oh, of course. And that's because in the musical, that's the signal, right? The music ends, you as an audience member know to clap,
right.
The song is over, the next song will begin.
This is the ending of One Night in Bangkok. Boom.
That's
done.
All, folks.
So, you know, this brings up the question of songs from musicals
right.
becoming hits.
Right. it used to happen in the 60s. So,
sure.
You know, Hello Dolly was a number one song. People from Funny Girl was a number five song, Barbara Streisand. And then, you know, Murray Head, our friend Murray Seafield St. George Head, had a hit with Superstar back in 71. But that really faded out during the rock era, as we were discussing. So essentially, very, very few songs now cross over from stage to the pop charts. In fact, Murray Head and One Night in Bangkok was the very last one to hit even the top 20. And really, it's also given life to Chess as well, because Chess is one of those sort of so-called problem musicals. You know, it's a musical where people really loved the score. So you listen to the cast album, you're like, oh, this is crazy. This is interesting. Like the synthesizers, the rock thing, blah, 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 blah. But the book was considered terrible. They tried to fix the book. The show opened in London and ran, actually, for a couple of years. It came to Broadway and became a huge flop. It was only here for 2 months. And Richard Nelson, the playwright, was brought in to fix the book. He's now actually at the Public with his Apple Family cycle of plays. He was brought in to fix Chess. It didn't work. It closed after 2 months. And there have been many, many productions that have tried to revive this musical and fix it. And Tim Rice has rejiggered it around the entire time. He's moved One Night in Bangkok into the first act, lengthened it. I mean, that song is trying to give it more legs in the show. And it's beloved by like real musical theater geeks, but not by critics and audiences.
But the song continues to kind of, you know, come back. You know, it, just when you think it's dead and buried, it resurrects itself.
Oh, yeah.
Including a recent a shot in the arm from an unexpected source, right?
Yeah, very unexpected. The Hangover Part 2 has a long segment with Mike Tyson singing quote unquote One Night in Bangkok. And if you think the Murray Head rap has trouble sticking to the beat, the Mike Tyson version will really surprise you.
What do you mean? You see one crowded, polluted, stinky town? Get tired of talking to a tourist whose every move's among the purest. I get my kick above the waistline, sunshine. One night in Bangkok makes a hard man humble. Not much between despair and ecstasy.
You know, that, I'm totally at a loss for words here.
Well, on the plus side, it goes to show there are some limits to auto-tune. There's some things you just cannot fix in post, and that's one of them. You know, I didn't think about how some of the lyrics, when sung by Mike Tyson, take an added layer of irony. The whole idea that he gets his kicks above the waistline, I don't know about that.
Yeah,
but anyway, yeah. So that was a little bit sort of a rebirth of the song just a few years ago.
Oh, my goodness. So will we ever see It's Like again? You know, a song from a musical, whether failed or successful, hitting the very upper echelons of the American pop charts?
You know, that's a great question. I wonder. Here's the reason why I think there is still a little bit of hope. And that's because with so many of these musicals now coming from the movies and being made, remade for the stage, not saying it's a good thing, but because it is happening, you are sort of now bringing back sort of pop culture elements onto the stage. So I can see them essentially then having kind of that bounce back. But certainly stylistically, in terms of where music has gone, you wouldn't think that they would make a natural transition back.
Well, I think when they were first putting Spider-Man together and got Bono and the Edge from U2 to write the score, I'm sure somebody was thinking, hey, we're going to get like top 10 singles out of this.
And right, exactly.
It did not happen.
They got something out of it, but not that.
Mario Correa writes and regularly contributes to Entertainment Weekly Live on Sirius XM, and he's been with us in the Soundcheck studio for this installment of That Was a Hit. And yes, indeed, in 1985, One Night in Bangkok from the musical Chess, featuring Murray Head, was in fact a hit. Mario, thanks for the look back.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank God I'm only watching the game, controlling it. I don't see you guys rating the kind of mate I'm contemplating. I'd let you watch, I would invite you, but the queens we use would not excite you.
The virtuoso electric bassist Steven Bruner has gigged with the singer Erykah Badu and fellow LA natives Snoop Dogg, Flying Lotus, and Suicidal Tendencies. Bruner joins us next to play songs from his second solo record, recorded under his cartoonish moniker, Thundercat. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you grew up in the 1980s, and if you watched TV after you came home from school, there's a good chance you watched The Thundercats. If you haven't seen the show, well, how do I describe them? It's sort of a fantasy sci-fi thing about a bunch of man-cats with superpowers and eyes that glow in the dark, and they're all battling a mummy named Mum-Ra. I know this because it turns out that the Soundcheck staff is infested with Thundercats fans. We are also fans of Steven Bruner, the virtuoso songwriter and electric bassist who goes by the name Thundercat. We'll talk with him about his latest album, Apocalypse, in a moment. But first, Thundercat and his band are here to play live for us. This is Tron Song, live on Soundcheck.
Don't you know you rock my world? Don't you ever leave me turbo drunk? Don't ever wonder where I'm going. I always come back. We'll be right back.
That is Thundercat and a live performance of Tron Song, which you will find on the latest Thundercat release called Apocalypse. Thundercat is Stephen Brunner, who sings and plays a six-string electric bass.
Yeah.
Four wasn't good enough. Five wasn't good enough. He had to go for the six, the six-pack. Ronald Brunner playing drums. Dennis Hamm behind the keyboards here in the Soundcheck studio. So let me ask you, did you grow up, were you one of those kids who came home from school in the 80s and watched Thundercats on TV?
I don't even remember if I was going to school. Was I going to school? I think I was going to school. Yeah, I was that kid, though. Yeah, it was pretty long ago. And, yeah, I would, you know, sit and stare at the screen, you know, kind of the same thing I do now.
Was there music in the house as well? Did you you come from a musical family?
Yeah, everybody in my family they're all musicians.
So yeah. What did your parents play?
Well, my dad played the drums, and my mom also played flute and percussion. And you know, my dad would write songs too, you know. And it was just kind of all over the house. You know, my older brother plays drums, obviously, and then my younger
brother.
Since
he's here with you today.
Yeah. And then my younger brother plays piano also.
Right.
Yeah.
So was there ever a doubt that this would be where you chose to go?
Nah. I mean, well, actually, yeah, at one point, I'm also a visual artist. And I remember when I was younger, I actually did want to go to art school. And my dad was like, "Nah, man, you're a musician."
Well, you are a musician, and you know, playing with people like Erykah Badu and Snoop Dogg and Suicidal Tendencies, you are all over the map.
Yeah. Well.
Which, you know, I mean, people always ask, you know, if you do many different types of music, well, how do you keep? I mean, it's as if.
I mean, well, the goal is
as if you would eat the same kind of food every day.
Right. You know, the working class musician stuff. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not the only one, you know.
Right.
And but it's at the same time, it's one of those things where it was just, you know, the opportunity, you know, and also just, you know, the people that I work with are so amazing. You know, they were very caring and also nurturing and bringing this out of me, so to speak, I guess, you know.
And one of those would probably be the artist, the electronic artist known as Flying Lotus. You've done a lot of work with him. You guys had that kind of big song a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And he helped produce this new record, right?
Yeah, he executive produced it. You know, he definitely had a hand in it.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know what to say. I mean, the guy's he's a great guy. You know?
Let me ask. I mean, growing up in a musical family, you would eventually have to have looked outside the house for some musical heroes.
Oh yeah.
Where did you look? Who did you settle on?
Well, I mean, you know, naturally, there's always the Jaco Pastorius and Stanley Clarke, of course. You know, bigger influences in my life musically,
and
Herbie Hancock,
great bass players.
Yeah, you know, the standards kind of, you know. And then along with that, I was just very exposed to a lot of stuff outside of the house too, working with people, you know.
Have you worked with Herbie Hancock, the great keyboard player?
Yeah.
And he's another guy who, I mean, look at his career. He's done, like, you know, standard jazz standards.
Oh,
he's done, you know, kind of groundbreaking electronic kind of groove-based stuff.
Yeah, I think I have, like, every Herbie album.
Really?
Like, I'm serious. I think so.
That's got to be a room unto itself.
It really is. Like, this section of my iTunes that just is, like, it's just like it takes a second to get through it, and it's all Herbie.
Yeah. So now let me come back to this six-string bass that you're playing here today. It's the four regular strings that most electric bass guitarists have. Mm-hmm. What are the other two? Do you go up and down, or are they both up?
Yeah, well, it's standard tuning. It's like, you know, of course, the middle four are E, A, D, G.
Okay.
And then it's B on top and then C on the bottom.
So you can get up into the guitar area on top, and you can get even lower on the bottom.
And it's actually, it's not tuned, like, it's actually, the tuning is not the same as a guitar because the C at the top, you know, but it's like it allows me to still phrase it as if it was a guitar on bass, though, because it's still the same tuning as a bass.
And you're able to, you know, I remember when I was learning to play guitar, people would say, "Yeah, but you can't play chords on a bass." But clearly that's not true.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've always caught flack for playing a six string. You know, it's like people's expectation, or, you know, what do you need all of that for? You know, and it's like, you know, but my history with the bass, it has nothing to do with the fact that I play a six string usually. You know, so it's one of those things where it's like, you know, I don't know. I kind of had to, you know, I had to develop it personally myself too, because it actually hurt to play it at first.
to play the sixth string.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it has such a big, wide neck.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost comically wide.
It's pretty massive. I had to do it because, I had a smaller sixth string with a smaller neck, and it just started wearing my hands out. And I used to have to wrap my hands up, and I would get all these little nodes and stuff in my hands.
Yikes.
And then now, it's way bigger, it's like a lot more easier for me to play. I feel like my hands are more spread out a bit. So.
Yeah. We're speaking with Thundercat. His new album is called Apocalypse. They're playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. You want to put the six strings back in action?
Sure.
You want to do Evangelion next?
Yeah.
It's Thundercat with Ronald Bruner and Dennis Hamm. This is the single from the new record. It's called Heartbreaks and Setbacks. That's called Heartbreaks and Setbacks, another live performance in the Soundcheck studio from Thundercat. You'll find that on his latest album called Apocalypse. Thundercat is Steven Brunner, who sings and plays the bass, and on that song, drummer Ronald Brunner and keyboard player Dennis Hamm also providing some backing vocals. So as we mentioned earlier, Flying Lotus helped produce this new record, as he did with the first. And there's a kind of circle of friends, musicians slash friends, that seems to orbit around Flying Lotus there in California, one of whom passed away.
Yeah.
Austin Peralta,
yeah,
22 years old.
Yeah, he's a young genius, man.
And he played keyboards on your first record.
Yeah.
So, you know, how much of the heartbreaks and setbacks this album comes from, you know, that experience?
A lot of it, you know. It's like the second album actually was a tribute to Austin. And it's one of those things where it's like, it's funny. I every once in a while I'll listen to the albums, you know, because I'll try to. And I remember I haven't listened to the Golden Age in a while, and I listened to it, and I had to pull over, and I just brushed into tears because it was like the guy was all over the album.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, whoa, you know, it was like that did happen. You know, I'm happy that I had a chance to document his life to some degree while he was here,
right.
You know. And it's still very difficult to deal with. It's actually been a year. I think the last couple of days, it's been literally a year since he died. And it was one of those things where it's like I could still feel it, you know, very heavily.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm happy that I got a chance to cross paths with the guy growing up, you know.
He was 22, died of pneumonia. Folks, if you go online, on YouTube, you can find a video of Austin Peralta doing a version of the Mm-hmm song that you and Flying Lotus did.
Yeah.
Really nice version, too.
Yeah. There's actually the funny thing. There's a video on there, too, where me and him are actually playing. This is when I first started doing my own stuff. It was always just me and Austin, usually. And it was like I was really nervous. But there's this one video that I always look at, and it's literally like we're just playing in a sound check.
Mm.
And it just always reminds me of how simple things were between me and the guy, you know. And it's just, you know, miss him dearly.
Thundercat with us on Soundcheck today. The album's called Apocalypse. I asked you before who your sort of heroes were growing up. You mentioned people like Jocko and Stanley Clarke and stuff. Anybody out there now that sort of, you know, has caught your attention?
Oh, yeah. The funny thing
is crazy kids in that next generation.
Yeah, man. I listen to a lot of newer people, actually. I listen to a lot of rap.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm definitely very influenced by, like, you know, Tyler, the Creator, and you know, the ASAP Rockies and, you know, Drakes and all the cats of now. You know, I hang around like Mac Miller a lot, you know. And we just sit and have all these conversations and we write music and, you know, just, you know, it's a lot of fun. And I'm happy that I can share some of that with my peers. So,
well, I mentioned before, you know, the fact that it's like a circle, it's a community. And it's not just musicians, you're kind of friends as well. It seems like
absolutely.
That's an important part of it.
Yeah, L.A.'s a really big, small place.
Yeah.
That's the best way to put it, you know.
Well, most big cities are. I would say the same thing about New York. You know, a lot of small towns making up one big city. Thundercat, Steve, it's been great having you and the band playing for us here in the studio today. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us, man.
You can hear more from our session with Thundercat. There's an additional song on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, a look at the artists that made it onto Forbes' list of the highest grossing musicians in the world. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Madonna finished up her MDNA tour earlier this year, and just the tail end of that was enough to make her the highest paid musician in the world for 2013. But some of the other highest paid artists, and where their money came from, might surprise you. Joining us is Forbes writer Zach O'Malley-Greenberg, who put together that magazine's list of the world's highest paid musicians of the year. Zach, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Madonna tops the list. How good a year was it for the Material Girl?
It was a pretty epic year for the Material Girl, one of the best of her career. Huge tour, much bigger than the album itself, but that's kind of where the money is these days. And she cleaned up on the road. The whole tour grossed, I think, $305 million. And so we calculated her cut of that based on the amount of dates that fell into our scoring period.
So when you say 2013, it's like a fiscal year. It's like June 1st of 2012 to June 1st of 2013.
Yeah, we calculate it that way because we put out our annual celebrity issue every June. And so we want them to be as up to date as possible the minute it comes out. But we don't rank all of the musicians for the celebrity issue. So
okay.
save some nuggets for later.
So it's Madonna at the top of the list, but it could have been Lady Gaga, is that right?
It would have been tough for Lady Gaga to top Madonna last year. She makes the list at number two at $80 million because of a very lucrative tour, but she had to cut the end of it short because of an injury.
She had that hip surgery.
She only had, I think it was about a dozen dates left. It wouldn't have been enough to kind of catch up.
So touring is, for the most part, where the money is in the music industry.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think on this list, the top five are typically big touring acts. But a lot of them, like Madonna, you know, you'll see she'll go on the road every couple of years. But on the years that she doesn't tour, she won't necessarily make the list, or you know, maybe she won't be in the top 20.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at somebody like Jay-Z or Dr. Dre, they're constantly at, you know, 30, 40, 50 million. Dre and Diddy barely tour at all, and they hardly release any music. They're pretty consistent every year, kind of in the middle of the list.
So then how are they making tens of millions of dollars without touring and without getting the kind of royalties that you're talking about?
Right. It's mostly non-music-related ventures, although I guess it depends on your definition of related to music.
Well, so with Dre, it would be those Beats.
The Beats headphones. Correct. You know, that's by far his biggest source.
So, but near the top of your list is Bon Jovi, who, you know, in terms of, like, topping the record charts, you know, possibly a little past their sell-by date. And yet, there they are at number three on the list on the basis of touring.
That's right. I mean, Bon Jovi in a lot of ways is similar to Madonna in that so much of that income is driven by touring because they can sell out not only arenas but stadiums some of the time, too. Bon Jovi's latest tour is called Because We Can. I think that's the best way of putting it. You know, they don't even really need to release new music anymore. They've got so many hits and so many people who are willing, ready and willing to come back, not just in the U.S., but abroad, too.
We're speaking with Zach O'Malley-Greenberg from the magazine Forbes, who's written this article on the world's highest paid musicians, 2013. Find a link on our website at soundcheck.org. I think so far, Madonna, Lady Gaga, even Bon Jovi, you know, given that they have been very visible on the touring circuit, probably not going to surprise too many people. Number four may well surprise people.
Been a long day, no break. We made it to the middle of the week, and I'm thinking that I'm probably going to need to get to know you casually. Just having fun, two for one. Watch a good time get a little better. Ain't no ball and chain for the suits and
Toby Keith. How does this happen?
That's correct. Toby Keith at $65 million. He's the highest earning male solo act in all of music. And a lot of people haven't heard of him, at least, you know. Outside of country music. And that's kind of the reaction I've been getting. We actually did for Forbes, I wrote a cover on him a few months back, kind of dissecting his business empire. And the way I see it, he's the Jay-Z of country. He's got so many different extensions of his brand. Yes, he tours a lot, probably, you know, 50 shows a year, which is down from, you know, one or two or sometimes 300 earlier, very early in his career. But he's able to extend that brand through a bunch of different ways, and they all kind of connect. So he's got a record label.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a restaurant chain. He's got a mezcal line. And the list goes on.
Mezcal is sort of like tequila.
Smokier. And occasionally with a worm.
Yeah. Well, so does tequila.
Yeah, true. And so the way he does it is he'll sign an act to his record label. Then he'll put them out on a tour going around the country in his bars and grills, Toby Keith's I Love This Bar and Grill, named after his song. They're playing – it's his band on his stage. They're playing his music in the background. They're drinking his tequila – sorry, his mezcal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making a profit at every turn.
Capitalism at work.
Exactly. the cowboy capitalist is what we called him.
So Toby Keith – now, I mean, if you go just a few spots down on the list, you come to Taylor Swift. Toby Keith is making money when Taylor Swift makes money, right?
That's correct. He was a very early investor in Big Machine, which is the record label that signed Taylor Swift very, very early on. They've now got quite a roster. The label group has not only Taylor Swift, but Tim McGraw, Rascal Flatts, Reba McEntire. And Toby Keith still owns a small stake in that company. So every record that Taylor Swift sells, he's getting a little piece of that.
Now, there's the key. You said every record that she sells. Now, in this day and age, if you want to talk about selling records, you kind of have to talk about country music because that seems to be the only genre where people still sort of buy records as a matter of course.
That's correct. And if you look at Taylor Swift's latest album, it came out about a year ago. It sold over 1 million copies in its first week, which is basically unheard of now. I mean, you know, Eminem just had a banner week with just over 700,000.
Right.
You know, she got almost double that. So, you know, it's that combination of country and pop. And she sits kind of right on the top of both worlds there, which is a very lucrative position to be in.
So on your list of the highest paid musicians of 2013, there are country artists like Kenny Chesney and Tim McGraw, and they're touring, but they're still selling records.
Correct.
All right. We're speaking with Zach O'Malley Greenberg of Forbes magazine, talking about his article, The World's Highest Paid Musicians 2013. Find a link to it on our website, soundcheck.org. With live bands out there touring and people with their lines of clothing and their restaurants like Toby Keith with the drinks and the restaurants and the record labels, all of that kind of makes sense. When you get to DJs, though, I mean, Calvin Harris, again, making an eight-figure salary as a DJ. Is he the highest paid DJ in the world?
Calvin Harris is the highest paid DJ in the world, $46 million in the past year alone.
I feel so close to you right now, it's a force field. I wear my heart upon my sleeve like a big deal. Your love pours down on me, surround me like a waterfall. And there's no stopping us right now, I feel so close to you.
This song by Calvin Harris, Feel So Close, big hit, lots of radio play, tons of club play, and you heard it on TV commercials too.
He is really benefiting from this boom in live concerts for DJs. These DJs can go out and get sometimes six figures a night just to play at a club that, you know, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people will come through over the course of a night. You know, if you look at the new Vegas club, Hakkasan, it's a really good example. They sign up a lot of these DJs to residencies, and they promise them, you know, six-figure sums just to play for one night. And Calvin Harris, on a big night, could get $200,000-$300,000. And unlike a big pop act, he's not bringing backup dancers and the whole shebang. You know, he's got his setup, but it's you know, very... small.
His profit margins are
extremely high. I mean, he can cart around his whole setup on a thumb drive if he wants to.
But he's not the only DJ on the list, right?
That's right. Tiesto. He's a Dutch DJ. He's actually over 40. One of the, you know, kind of older in the DJ set.
Yep.
you know, but he's...
He's over 40 years old, not over 40 million.
Oh, correct. He's at 32 million.
Mere bag of shells, as Ralph Cramden used to say. So what keeps the perennials on the list? Your Bruce Springsteens, your Elton Johns, your Paul McCartneys?
The three of them just tour constantly. You know, Paul McCartney is putting out new music all the time. Doesn't make that much from the music, but, you know, he can go and sell out a baseball stadium at the drop of a hat. You know, same goes for Bruce Springsteen. Same goes for Elton John. Elton John plays Vegas all the time. You know, and these guys are all getting tons of royalties from their old hits. When it comes to Diddy or Dre, it's a pretty steady business to have, you know, a giant headphone line mm-hmm. or an incredible deal with a vodka company that, you know, basically just keeps getting bigger and bigger every year. And they don't even really need to tour anymore.
So with the veterans, would the Rolling Stones, would Paul McCartney, would Bruce Springsteen make your list if they were not touring in a year where they took time off?
If they were not touring, they would probably not make the list. The cutoff is around $30 million. They'd be in the tens of millions most likely, right. But not quite up to that, you know, 30, 32 million if they weren't touring.
Well, as we look at the top 20 and see all these familiar names, there is one name that, you know, will not be familiar to a number of people, and that is Muse.
And now I need to know, is this real love? Or is it just madness keeping us afloat?
This is the band Muse and their song Madness. Kind of big arena rock band, certainly popular and known within, you know, their generation circle, but not really well known outside of that.
It's funny too, you know, they pop up on the list more years than not, and it always surprises a few people, even at Forbes. They're like, who's Muse? But you know, they've actually been around for quite a while.
Yeah.
You know, it's a younger audience, I think, than the Bruce Springsteens and the Elton Johns of the world. It's an older audience probably than the Taylor Swifts of the world and the Calvin Harrises. But it's, you know, it's an audience that has a fair amount of expendable income and, you know, has a lot of enthusiasm for their music such that they can sell out arenas and, you know, really have a broad base around the world.
So again, we're talking about a band that does a lot of serious touring.
Yeah, if they're on there, it's because they were touring.
You do make the caveat that these are all living artists, which seems like a needless thing to say until you get the follow-up, which is?
When you look at Michael Jackson, he would actually be the number one earner in all of the music world if we considered artists who have passed on.
Zach, it's a fascinating article. There's a link to it on our website, soundcheck.org. Good to see you again. Thanks very much.
You betcha. Appreciate it.
On the show, the new album from jazz bassist Ben Allison has a high-energy rock feel and a title that tips its hat to an old David Bowie song. Ben Allison and his band play live. And Lisa Crone wrote the book and lyrics for the new musical Fun Home, which is playing at the Public Theater through the end of December. Lisa Crone will talk about Fun Home and give us a Pick 3 playlist. Plus, the NFL teams in Kansas City and Seattle are battling it out for the title of loudest football stadium after a Chiefs game recently topped 137 decibels. And since this is totally crazy, we just have to talk about it tomorrow on the show. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.